Case number 16-7108. Chantel Adias, individually and on behalf of all others similarly situated at L Appellants versus Care First Inc., doing business as Group Hospitalization and Medical Services Inc., doing business as Care First of Maryland Inc., doing business as Care First Blue Cross Blue Shield, doing business as Care First Blue Choice Inc. at L. Mr. Nace for the appellants, Mr. Gatewood for the appellees.
May it please the court, Jonathan Nace on behalf of the appellants, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of time for rebuttal. CareFirst promised to protect its customers' data. In May of 2015, defendants announced that data thieves had stolen from their servers the names, birthdays, email addresses, and account numbers of more than a million consumers.
Mr. Nace, would you please start with jurisdiction? And in particular, I would really like you to explain why you never addressed our decision in Murray. We cited Murray in our order asking for supplementary briefs. We included a key quote from Murray, quote, "Dismissal of action without prejudice is a final disposition, while dismissal of complaint without prejudice typically isn't."
If we did not address that thoroughly enough.
You didn't address it at all. Here we have a court who says to you, we're concerned about our jurisdiction, and we cite a case. Not a peep in your brief about that case. Now, maybe the case is distinguishable, but why wouldn't you have made an effort to tell us why Murray doesn't control this?
We should have, Your Honor.
And okay. Would you like to now explain that?
Well, I think in this case, the district court dismissed the entire case, which is what I thought.
Excuse me?
In the district court
here dismissed the complaint. In Sorelli, they dismissed the action. Mm-hmm. Here, the district court dismissed the complaint.
And I know your Honor's obviously correct that that's the words he used. But as we stated in our supplemental brief, and I think as the appellees agree, the district court was dismissing the action in the form of there was nothing else that could have been done. There was nothing else that we could have pled.
Well, there were suggestions in Judge Cooper's opinion that there were things that you could have done, that you could have pled with greater specificity on the chain of inferences, right? You could have pled Social Security numbers were stolen or credit card numbers.
We did address the Social Security numbers. We moved for discovery on that point. We moved to have some subject matter jurisdiction. And actually, in the district court's order, he denied that motion. And in his footnote, he said, look, I am agreeing with the affidavit that was submitted. Social Security numbers were not taken. And he ruled on that he agreed that they had not been and accepted that fact of the defendant. So I don't think we could have then pled that they were without drawing the ire of the district court.
Well, see, I read the opinion the same way Judge Griffith did. It looked to me like there were several places in which the district court wasn't saying you might not ever have standing. He was just saying, the record wasn't sufficient. Here, I'll give you an example. He says at one point, plaintiff failed to explain how identity theft could happen without stolen Social Security numbers or credit card numbers. Okay? He didn't say identity theft couldn't happen. He said you hadn't explained it. Just that you hadn't explained it. And you could have simply easily done that by filing an amended complaint saying what your amicus does, which explains how identity mm-hmm. theft can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So
And I took that as, Your Honor, I took that as we hadn't explained it adequately or in a way that he was accepting.
Well, where do you see that?
Well, he did not state that it wasn't adequate, but what he said was they haven't explained it. And we took that as I don't agree with you, because we definitely pled and we argued in our opposition that this is a real risk of harm that can happen, that identity theft happens from what has been lost here. And this is years of surveillance and monitoring that the plaintiffs have to go through here. And so I thought we presented that to him, and he ruled that we cannot
explain.
Why
do you think he dismissed your complaint without prejudice?
Because it was a 12B1 issue.
Without prejudice?
Yes, because it was a 12B1 issue that he did not reach the merits, and he did not...
Correct. That's why he dismissed it without prejudice. Mm-hmm. Because on the record, this is the way I read it, on the record before him, he just didn't think you had satisfied. I thought, looked to me like he was giving you another shot at it.
I did not presume that, and I didn't think the appellees presumed that either. It appeared to me
well,
that
we're not the appellees who have to presume it. It's your case.
Yes.
And what you and the appellees agree to is our jurisdiction isn't binding on us, right? We have to satisfy ourselves.
I'll give you another example. He says, the district court says, with the exception of two plaintiffs, none allege that they suffered actual identity theft. Mm-hmm. And then in footnote 4, he says, although plaintiff's opposition to the motion to dismiss asserts that many plaintiffs have already suffered identity theft, credit fraud, etc., and the victims of the breach other than the Tringlers have, the complaint contains no factual allegations to support those. So he's saying, look, they're in your complaint, they're in your motions, but they're not in the complaint. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, they're in your motions, but they're not in the complaint. That tells me that he's saying, amend your complaint and put them in.
But we asked for jurisdiction to be able to do that. For jurisdictional discovery to be able to do that. I mean, we
so
have
let me
the
go
fact.
Back, let me go back to the first question I asked you about Murray. Okay? You agree with me that here, as in Murray, the complaint, not the action, was dismissed.
I'm sorry, I just didn't hear you.
The complaint was dismissed with out prejudice, not the action. Same case. And we said in Murray, that's not a final appealable order. So now tell us how you would distinguish Murray.
The way we distinguish Murray is that there was no facts that we could have added, that we could have further alleged, that would have changed the pleadings in
this
case.
You see, the position you're putting us in here by taking that position is you're asking us now to decide whether there was any additional information you could have pleaded that would have satisfied the district court. You had a totally simple solution to this problem. If you didn't think you could have done anything further, you could have gone back to the district court and asked him to enter a final appealable order. And then we wouldn't have wasted all of our time here.
Well, I did not foresee that because I did not read the order that way. I read the order as a dismissal of the action in the sense...
Well, but had you read Murray, Murray was the law of the circuit at the time. Right. And Murray says dismissals of a complaint without prejudice are not final orders. That's the law of the circuit.
Mm-hmm. But clearly other law says that dismissals on subject matter jurisdiction are final appealable orders, which is what we had here. Uh-huh. And that's what we were proceeding on.
Well, the
on.
Question is, do we have, certainly if it's dismissed on jurisdictional grounds, it's appealable. The question I'm asking you, and Judge Griffith is asking you, is if you look at this order and the way the court handled it, it doesn't look like it's a final dismissal for jurisdictional purposes yet. He hasn't gotten there. He didn't even remove it from his active docket.
I read the order as a final appealable order.
Let me make sure that I understand. Is your argument sort of a futility argument that you had already explored the avenues or tried to explore the avenues that would lead to an amendment of the complaint along these lines and that the judge had denied you that, so therefore... Your understanding of that combined with the order is that he wasn't inviting amendment?
Right. Our argument is that these plaintiffs did not have any additional facts to add. There's no one else to say this many people have suffered identity theft or two other plaintiffs have suffered identity theft as well. We had alleged everything that we could have alleged.
What about being explicit about your belief that Social Security numbers were taken? It's in there, but it seems as though the district court wasn't reading your complaint the same way you were reading your complaint. Mm-hmm. And so that's a type of thing that's easily fixed by having an explicit thing that says, we allege that, among other things, Social Security numbers were taken. And some of the other things that Judge Tatel referenced, and here's the, not just that there's a vague harm, but explicitly here's the harm that we're worried about from the information, the type of information that was taken. Here's why it creates a substantial risk, in our client's view, of identity theft or medical fraud that they'll be responsible for. Is there anything?
Well, as to the Social Security numbers, I mean, we did address that in our supplemental brief, that he ruled that they were not taken based upon the affidavit that was submitted by the defendant. And he denied our request to depose that witness. As to harm, I mean, we did allege harm that in the form of mitigation expenses, in the form of increased risk of fraud. All of these additional harms were alleged in the complaint, and he ruled that they were not sufficient under Article 3.
Maybe if you laid out exactly what the mitigation expenses are that you're referring to.
I believe we did.
In the complaint itself?
I believe so, Your Honor, yes. And I know we allege that the Tringlers, that we allege specifically that they had already suffered tax refund fraud.
Yeah, no, that's definitely there. But that the district court hadn't focused on that because the district court, well, I mean, I read your complaint as alleging Social Security numbers being taken, but it could be more directly alleged, and so the district court saw it differently, and that's easily fixed, and then that takes care of the district court's concern about Social Security numbers. That links up when you make that direct allegation, if you can, assuming you can, on a good faith basis here, make that allegation, then that will link up to the tax refund fraud, because he didn't see the direct allegation, and then from that didn't see what the connection was to tax refund fraud. But when you have that, and again, I see the words in your complaint, but it's not as direct as a specific one-line allegation. I'm just telling you, I need you to fix this.
I agree that's true with Social Security numbers.
You don't want the opportunity to fix this complaint?
Again, when the district court ruled in his memorandum opinion, that Social Security numbers were not taken, we were hesitant to tell him they were when he had already ruled at that point that they were not.
Okay. We'll hear from the other side. Good. Mr. Gatewood.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Good morning, Your Honors. On behalf of the Care First appellees, Matt Gatewood, may it please the Court. And Your Honors, I'm happy to start with the jurisdictional question if you prefer, or I can go right into it.
Well, do you have any, I mean, you filed a brief saying you thought we had jurisdiction.
That's right, and I do, because if you look at, I think this situation is very different than assume we had just filed, for example, a 12B6 motion.
Never mind, go ahead. Just curious about your strategy, but I won't ask you that. And go ahead.
The district court, if it decides the 12B6 motion goes to the merits of the case, for example. So if the words with prejudice, without prejudice, those matter in that situation. Because the district court, if they decide merits without prejudice, certainly it's an invitation to replead the complaint. But when the district court is, as a threshold matter, determining its subject matter jurisdiction, it is making a decision that it cannot reach the merits.
Correct. But the question we were asking counsel was, we totally agree with you about that. The question is, had the district court actually reached that decision? He dismissed it without prejudice. He didn't remove it from his docket. And his opinion is full of statements like plaintiffs have failed to prove or failed to explain or failed to do this. So it doesn't look like, from what we have here, that this district judge had gotten to the point where he had, in his mind, dismissed the case for jurisdictional reasons.
Yes, Your Honor, but these appellants have relied and stood on their complaint. They did not file a Rule 59 motion with the district court with a motion with leave to amend the complaint. They instead chose to appeal the action as they treated it as a final one.
But the plaintiffs can't, by their actions, convert an unappealable order into an appealable order. You agree with that?
I agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay. And we have Murray. The only possible basis for distinguishing Murray, you've actually put your finger on it, is that here the dismissal was for jurisdictional reasons, right?
That's right. Sorowski and Murray deal with the merits.
But the fact is that still leaves open the question of what the district court intended here.
Your Honor, in their supplemental briefing to this court, appellants have said, I think in three instances, that there are no additional allegations that they can add to their complaint to cure what the district court said was deficient.
Wouldn't it have been, they're telling us that, right? Well, couldn't they have simply said to the district court, Your Honor, thanks for the dismissal without prejudice, but we can't satisfy your standard and we want to appeal and our final order.
Well, they did by not filing a Rule 59 motion and instead filing their appeal.
Say, right.
But the core of this issue, Your Honor, is
that... Did you object to them if they went back and wanted to file a third amended complaint? Did you object to that just to address this issue and make it concrete for both all the parties in the district court, the
Your
status
Honor,
of this?
The problem with that is that they've yet to explain any concrete injury. And a federal court plaintiff
to... Well, presumably they would try again, and you would reserve full rights to disagree that you satisfy that job. I'm just asking as a procedural matter, given the status, would you object to them filing a third amended complaint? And then we can get a clear ruling from the district court on whether it really was done or whether they just need a little more explication or specificity.
I think, Your Honor,
the allegations.
There's an interim step that the case could be remanded to the district court for explanation as to whether it was a final and appealable order. If this court is just looking for the words final and appealable, and the district court did in fact deem that dismissal a final and appealable order, I think that would be the more appropriate.
That would be another step, but would you object to them filing a third amended complaint, just as a procedural matter? I'm not saying you will agree that it will be sufficient under either 12b1 or 12b6.
I understand it. If the court determines it does not have jurisdiction to hear the appeal, then that would be the next course.
That's not answering my question.
Yeah. You know, I don't understand your argument that they haven't shown any harm. I mean, this case is very different from Clapper. Here the data has been stolen, intentionally stolen. It's in the hands of somebody who obviously wouldn't have stolen it had they not intended to use it. It just doesn't seem to me at all speculative under these circumstances to say that they have standing.
But the harm they're alleging is a harm based on a future fear of injury.
Right.
And
but it's not a speculative one.
Well, it is
when these people stole all this data.
Yes,
right?
Your Honor.
And at the time of the complaint, it was stolen. And obviously, I assume they didn't steal it just to collect it. They stole it to use it, right?
Here's the problem, Your Honor. Not one plaintiff has explained why any single piece of information that they allege was compromised has caused them harm or will cause them harm. They have not alleged that. And they have not alleged how any of that,
is that data
fairly traceable.
In paragraphs 51 and 54 of the second amended complaint, they allege that identity theft from stealing medical information will harm them. They have alleged that.
It will harm them.
Under Clapper, the inquiry is substantial risk, right? And so we're supposed to determine, have they alleged a substantial risk of harm? And I don't see how they haven't.
They haven't for three reasons, Your Honor. The first is the type of data that they allege was stolen. Email addresses, names, birthdays, subscriber identification numbers.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Second, it's been almost
What's insufficient about that?
It's sufficient if they can take any piece of that information and then explain why they're harmed, but they have not done that. They haven't explained how it's possible to be harmed in the future based on those pieces of information, just like the Supreme Court said in Spokio.
But that list comes from the Hauser Declaration that you just gave. And the Hauser Declaration doesn't say that's an exhaustive list. He says what was taken from these tables included those things. Doesn't tell us what else it included. And nothing in the Hauser Declaration actually says, all it says is that Social Security numbers and health information weren't in the CIM database, but I see no specific statement by Mr. Hauser that the other databases were not compromised and that other information was not taken. In fact, that careful choice of included suggests that either you all don't know exactly how much was taken or we're not being told everything. We're only told about one computer getting into one database without any exclusion of other information. So why do they, at the complaint stage, have to accept your description, which is not your entire description, and then argue off of that?
They don't, Your Honor. And I don't need the declaration for this argument. The district court even said that they had not alleged, for example, that their Social Security numbers were stolen.
No, they do. They absolutely say Social Security numbers. They absolutely do.
They say it's possible.
They say that they included Social Security numbers, and then they say we suffered tax refund fraud, which requires use of a Social Security number. I mean, this is a complaint stage. We're not at the summary judgment stage here.
I understand that, but they still have to establish, they don't have to establish, they have to plausibly state each claim of standing. And based upon the current complaint, they do not do that.
What's implausible when they say that you don't deny that you guys collected Social Security numbers, that you had their Social Security numbers, there's no denial of that, and that your databases were broken into. And they say, that's the information, you had all this information on us, and it was taken. Information was taken. And we believe it was Social Security numbers, because look what happened right after that. We had a tax refund fraud. Why is that not a sufficient allegation?
Your Honor, I disagree that they have alleged that Social Security numbers were stolen. The district court also disagrees with that.
What do you make of their claims that there were statutory violations, consumer protection violations? Under Spokio, that's a pretty relaxed standard, isn't it?
Well, it still requires a concrete harm, and that concrete harm can be tangible or intangible, as this court has also said in Hancock, which was decided shortly after Spokio. And because the risk of harm that they present is not substantial, so the risk of harm, when viewed under the framework that the Supreme Court reiterated in Clapper, that's how you're viewing this alleged intangible harm. It's, if it's not substantial, it can't be a concrete injury for purposes of attaching to a statutory violation in order to confer standing when that statutory violation itself doesn't work.
So is your argument, if we don't feel there is substantial harm, Spokio is of no help to them, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. They argue their standing, they say three issues of standing in their statement of issues in the appellant's brief. One is the mitigation damages, one is the fear of future identity theft, and the third is the statutory violations but combined with a concrete harm. In the lower court, they actually said that the statutory violation itself conferred standing.
I thought under Spokio the injury had to be concrete. You have to prove your damages at the complaint stage.
That's absolutely right. There has to be a fact of injury, though.
Okay. If I were to go into a Segway rental place and give them, and they said, while you're using the Segway, you have to leave your driver's license here. And then they're negligent with it. Lay it out on the sidewalk. Someone steals that driver's license. Have I been injured? Someone steals my driver's license, have I been injured?
Possibly.
Have I been injured?
If you can
I'm not injured unless someone does something bad with my driver's license. Until then, I'm just not injured.
Well, this is very different than like a Fair Credit Reporting Act situation where there's an obligation to not to disclose certain information. There's no allegation in the complaint that CareFirst disclosed any information.
No, it was stolen. So it was stolen. They would say that they will say, and I'm not suggesting this is true or not one way or the other, was that I assume that CareFirst was negligent in its handling of their information. And if I were to say the same thing about the Segway dealer, they were negligent because they left license plates out on the sidewalk. And it was stolen. Can I sue them? I've been injured. My license was taken because of their negligence.
You can allege that the law confers on you a right to that information, and then you can assert a deprivation of that right.
I'm telling you what I'm
alleging. That's the definition of injury
in fact. Says I left my driver's license with them. They were negligent in handling it, and someone stole it. Have I been injured?
If you can explain that in your complaint to a federal court, that you had a legally protected right that was then deprived.
Did I have my driver's license stolen through their negligence? That's my allegation.
If you believe that you have a legally protected right to that information in the driver's license, then you can make out a federal court complaint.
I'm asking you that question.
I think a driver's license, information on a driver's license is very different than the information that they allege was taken here.
Anything else?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Did Mr. Nace have any time left? Okay. You can have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. First of all, I believe it was Judge Millett. The mitigation expenses were pled on appendix page 5, paragraph 19, with specificity. Your Honor touched on the difference between this case and Clapper, and I just wanted to say very quickly, Your Honor is absolutely right. I mean, this is nothing like the Clapper situation, and the reason it's not like that is, in Clapper, none of the plaintiffs could have alleged that they had had a legal interest that had already been invaded. They were speculating that at some point in the future, their legal interest would be invaded by the conduct of what was happening to other people. But in this case, when the data breach occurred...
What's your theory of standing under Spokio?
I'm sorry, I just didn't hear it. You said
what's your theory of standing under Spokio?
Under Spokio. So Spokio is a case regarding what they called a purely procedural violation of a statutory right. And what Spokio said was that is not in and of itself enough, but it can be enough if additional harms are confronted with that.
So what are your additional harms?
Additional harms include mitigation expenses and risk of future injury, future identity theft. But this case is different from that. This circuit, and Your Honor, has already stated that in D.C., the D.C. Consumer Protection provides a substantive right to be free from deceptive trade practices. And that, from Worth all the way through Spokio, those substantive rights, violations of them, can confer standing on their own.
In your briefs, I only found a reference to the invasion of a privacy tort. Mm-hmm. I didn't see, in your complaint, you talk about generally about fraud and breach of contract, but not in your briefs. Did you abandon those arguments?
No, in our briefs, what we stated was that there was tangible harm in the form of pecuniary loss with this violation of the statutory rights as well. And we said there's also intangible harms that go with that violation also, the intangible harms being the invasion of privacy and risk of future identity theft, emotional injury, things like that. But we have both tangible and intangible harms in conjunction with violations of statutory rights. Even if we're talking about a procedural statutory right, that's still enough under Spokio because we've alleged these further concrete harms. But also, Your Honor, you know, the question to the driver's license, the answer to the driver's license question that you had is the injury is in the negligence that occurred. Injury as injury in fact is whether or not the plaintiffs had a legally protected interest. There's always been a legally protected interest to not be unreasonably harmed by another. That's the legally protected interest. That doesn't mean you can state a claim under 12b-6. Similarly, there's always been a legally protected interest to what you contract for. Doesn't mean you can state a claim under 12b-6, but these common law protected interests, breach of contract, negligence, these things have always been there, and they've always conferred standing to a plaintiff who alleges them.
Okay. Thank you. Case is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.